I'm Ken Hemmons and he is Chris Lang. Welcome to the first edition of this series of property briefings. And also a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Well, thanks, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, most people will already know you as the sellout author of How Investing in Commercial Property Really Works and CEO of Property Edge Australia. So the question is, where should we start? Maybe with the 9-step investment formula, which you've been using to help clients successfully acquire commercial property over the past 30 years or so. Perhaps, Chris, you might like to unpack that for the benefit of our listeners and also explain just how and why you put it together in the first place.
Okay, well, look, I think that probably goes back to the mid-1980s when, during that time, over a 3 or 4 year period, I sold about $140 million worth of commercial property. Now, in today's dollars, that's probably $500 million worth. So it was a fair amount. And I say that not to boast, but more to say that I covered a fair spectrum of commercial property and what it took to put a deal together. So it was a reasonably busy time. But in 89, we had the commercial property crash. Now, the stock market had crashed in 87, a couple of years before, but the property, about Easter of 89, absolutely fell apart. And between then and 90, early part of 1991, the market fell by, in some cases, up to 50%, but generally across the board, it fell by about 40%. So I had an agency that had a lot of salespeople when the market turned. We had a lot of listings, but we didn't have a lot of buyers. And so in 1991, I decided to make the switch. And by that, I mean started to act for high net worth individuals or people with high salaries who had the capacity to borrow. Now, these investors I affectionately called wealthy amateurs because they had a fair amount of money or access to money, and a lot of them had pulled it out of the stock market in 1987, but they didn't have a lot of expertise as far as sourcing and analysing and acquiring commercial property. But they had too much money to continue to buy residential because that was generally small amounts of money, and they felt they needed some help in acquiring more sizable, more substantial property, and that really meant moving into commercial. So they were effectively cashed up with a smorgasbord of properties to choose from, but little experience in how to analyse the opportunities and put those deals together. So I started acting for this group of investors and showed them how to start taking advantage of all the bargains that were on offer. Now, I guess I was probably what you would call the first buyer's advocate, as they're known now, but it was in commercial property. Now, I found there was no shortage of clients, but interestingly, they were like little sponges. They wanted to learn more. Now, at that point, I'd written and had published 4 books on property, and yet they wanted to learn even more. And so I launched the first commercial property website in 1995 to start to provide the opportunity for these investors to learn more about commercial property at their own pace. Now, my approach was to help them, and in making the transition from selling agent to a buying agent, the help I was giving them was largely intuitive based on the experience that I'd built up during that time in the 1980s. But these clients wanted to learn more of what they perceived as the apparent secrets behind what commercial agents do. And the extraordinary thing was that once I started to explain this to these investors, I began to get calls from other commercial agents saying things like, "Chris, you can't tell people this sort of information. This is like secret agent's business. You know, you've got to keep a lot of this stuff to yourself." And I reasoned that if these investors didn't fully understand the commercial property market, they weren't going to have the courage to move out of residential into the commercial market. And so I started to hold a series of closed-door workshops in Melbourne on a Saturday. And the funny thing is that 60% of those who attended actually came from interstate. And those workshops now have developed into a home study course which people can partake. And to prepare the information and the material for those full-day courses required me to dissect the entire commercial property acquisition process and pull it apart and put it back together again, because I needed to understand, if I was going to teach it to people, I needed to fully understand it. And in the process, I discovered a couple of interesting things. The first was that for it to work to your best advantage, those components needed to be reassembled in a different manner to what most people understood them to be. And the second one was that having created this new framework, you also needed to follow all of it in a sequential basis to ensure your success. So really, that's how and why the 9-step formula came about.
Now, how about quickly telling us what it involves?
Well, I'm not sure in the time available, Ken, that we're going to be able to cover everything there, because, as I said, it developed and evolved into a full-day course and then a home study course which people undertake over a 3 or 4 month period. But I think when we were talking before, you said you want to make these a series of weekly times together, so maybe progressively over that time we can and unpack it a bit further. But in simple terms, when you're acquiring a property, there are generally 3 phases. The first one is doing your homework, and that is to identify the properties and to shortlist ones that can potentially get onto a list to take to the next stage. And part of that is working to make sure that they fit within your investment objectives and your buying criteria. And if they don't, they don't make it to the next stage. And this second stage is what I've termed the final judgment, where you get into an in-depth financial analysis and you can very quickly sift through and distill down into a simple decision-making process that enables you to sift through that shortlist you've got and work out which is the one or maybe two, if you're lucky, 3 properties that are worth doing. And then the third part of doing your homework is to make sure that you're not paying too much, and that involves pre-valuing the property so that when it time comes to go borrow the money, that what you paid under the contract is not in excess of what a valuer would be prepared to stand by and support as far as a mortgage or a loan is concerned. So that's phase one, doing your homework. The second phase is when you bed down your purchase. Now, obviously that involves negotiating a deal, and most people seem to consider a negotiation to be an event. In actual fact, it's a process, and a lot of people try and rush it through. And so in this step, explaining the art of negotiating so that everyone walks away with a win-win solution, because if you win and they lose, that deal's not going to necessarily stick. You might agree shaking hands, but you might find that a lot of things fall apart between then and actually documenting the deal. Now, the next step in this second phase is you've got to validate your purchase, and that is undertake a due diligence, fully explore the physical attributes of the property and make sure that they're as you thought they were, but there's also the legal side of it, the tenancy side of it. And so it's the assessment of the property to make sure that the integrity is there and that you're not going to have any surprises down the track. So again, it's a skill, and it's part of the negotiating process to weave that into the arrangement so that you have time to do it. And a lot of people try and undertake their due diligence before they actually make their offers, which is a fatal mistake. And then other people run into trouble trying to include it as part of the contract conditions, and the deal falls apart. So there's a definite skill in including the due diligence, but as I said, weaving it into the negotiating process. And then the final step in this second phase is organising your loan and bedding all that down, because quite often this is where a lot of deals fall apart, because the banks, particularly in the current market, are extraordinarily difficult. They don't want to lend money. As the old saying, that they'll lend money to people that don't need it. And if you have committed to a contract, gone out and organised your, or think you've organised your loan, and you don't do it properly, you get caught very close to settlement, having to agree to terms that the banks suddenly impose, which really are not in your best interest. So again, there's a definite technique to ensuring that you control things all the way through to the end. And then there's the third phase, and that is maximising your overall profit. This is after you've bought the property and you've settled. This includes things like maximising your tax benefits through appreciation. It also includes adding value, and there are clever ways to add value at not too much expense. And that comes down to getting the right property manager, making sure that they are looking for all the avenues that are available to you to improve the value of your property. But I like to think that at the end of the first 12 months of your ownership, that your property remains from then on in ready-to-sell condition. And that doesn't mean you need to sell it, but it means that if circumstances change and you find yourself in a position that you are forced to sell, either through financial need or personal needs, that your property is in tip-top condition, everything organised, the value-add components are all completed so that a marketing campaign can be implemented straight away without any hiccups or delay. And then the final step in the third phase is the actual marketing of the property. And this is what I call the stealth marketing step. And this is to ensure that you leave nothing on the table at the end of the deal, because all those hard-won improvements and the value that you've added belong in your pocket. And there's a definite technique to making sure that the property is marketed. And it's not just a matter of putting an auction board on the property or running a tender or a private sale. There's a skill and technique that is necessary to make sure that you maximise your profit in all of this.
I know you've been talking about the nine-step formula, but there are probably a few people listening that might be wondering whether investing in commercial property is any better than residential property. And so could you possibly explain why your clients have found that to be the case?
Well, it's interesting. I guess most people are familiar with residential property because they live in it on a day-to-day basis. And the next extension of that, if they do have funds to invest, is to perhaps buy an apartment or a small house. And so there's a certain comfort level there. And when they look a little further, and it may be that they bought two or three residential properties and realise that there are issues involved with that, and I'll cover some of them in a moment, and they need to consolidate. So they start then to look at commercial property and, as you say, wonder why, if it is at all, better than residential. Perhaps the first reason would be longer leases. You see, quite often residential tenancies will be on a month-by-month basis, maybe 6 months. If you're lucky, you get a 12-month lease. But you find with commercial properties that the leases tend to be between 3 to 5 years, and sometimes often longer. I mean, some of the supermarket leases are up to 15, 20 years, but generally they're 3 to 5 years in length. Now, that means you have much fewer tenancy turnover, and your income stream is therefore far more predictable. And probably the second reason would be greater security. When residential tenants want to exit a 12-month lease, they simply find a suitable substitute tenant and they supply references, and all they simply pay is the transfer costs for that tenant to take over. Now, this new tenant then becomes responsible for the rent under the remainder of the lease. However, with commercial tenants, they're actually running a business from your property, and whenever they sell their business, they also are required to obtain an assignment of the lease. But here's the difference, that if a commercial tenant defaults in paying your rental, this new commercial tenant, you also have recourse to the previous tenant as well, because commercial leases are business contracts and they're enforceable by law. So you end up, certainly up until the exercise of the option, to have two parties that are liable for your rent, whereas residentially, all they have to do is satisfy that they have sufficient references, and then the lease is automatically assigned across to the incoming tenant. And probably the third reason would be that commercial tenants pay the outgoings. Now, typically, residential properties provide you with a 5% gross rental return. But from this, you need to pay your rates, your taxes, your insurance, your maintenance, and all the other outgoings, leaving you with about a 3.5% net return at the end of the year if you're lucky. Now, depending on what and where they are, commercial properties will generate anywhere from 5 to a 9% net rental return. And it's because the tenants pay the outgoing on top of the rental that makes whatever the tenants pay under the lease is a net return. And so whatever you receive, you can bank and spend rather than having to worry about having to pay these additional expenses out of your pocket throughout the term of the lease and before the end of the financial year. Also, as a fourth reason, if the toilet stops working in the apartment, the tenant asks you to send a plumber. And if it happens on the weekend, they have certain rights. They can call their own plumber because it's an emergency and they can't reach the managing agent. But a commercial tenant quickly attends to the problem themselves so as not to disrupt their business, because they are responsible for the outgoings, the maintenance and all those outgoings related to the property. And furthermore, the overall appearance of the property is a reflection upon them. And therefore, whether the lease requires it or not, most commercial tenants will regularly repair and repaint your property in order to maintain a good corporate image. The final reason that makes commercial property more appealing is that most residential properties are rented by individuals, and therefore the rent is generally paid in cash or by personal cheque. And this can often vary in its timing. But because they're running a business, commercial tenants consider rent as simply another regular expense each month. And generally this gets set up on an automatic bank transfer and can be specified as such under the lease. So the bottom line is that as a residential investor, you find yourself having a great deal of variances because you're dealing with individual people. However, as a commercial investor, you tend to enjoy a more predictable long-term relationship with your tenant because that's based on a proper business footing. So I think that's why most of my clients consider commercial property to be more appealing than residential.
Mm-hmm. We were chatting earlier about the various myths that tend to surround commercial property. So maybe it would be worthwhile exploring some of them to put everyone's mind at rest.
Well, I think there are probably four or five, there's probably a lot more, but the main ones. And that is, to start with, commercial property, that people think all you have to do is to go onto the internet and you'll find a property. But that's only half the task. The rest of it, as we discussed, is assessing the property both physically and financially, and then packaging the deal that is actually the best one for you. That's where having a good consulting team for property, legal, finance, construction, and all those sort of aspects are really worthwhile. So it's not as easy as you might think, but the secret is that you don't have to know everything. It's a matter of putting together your consulting team that can give you that expert advice, and they will be able to track down and package up deals far better than you will in the early time when you're starting out as a commercial investor. A second myth would be that residential investors will find it hard to make the transition to commercial property. And that stems mainly from a lack of knowledge and therefore a lack of proper understanding. And again, that's where your consulting team comes in, because some of my most successful clients have been those with little or no prior involvement in commercial property. However, they were very clear thinkers and could quickly assess the advice being given to them. And what's more important, they actually listen to that advice. And sometimes a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And as I said, putting your consulting team together early, you don't need to use all of them all of the time, but having the team there so you can call on their skills, knowledge and experience is going to save you so much money and get you far better deals over the long term. Now, the next myth is that you need a lot of cash. And again, it's simply not true, because, yeah, there's some commercial properties that may sell for millions of dollars, but there's also some well-leased strata offices that the suites sell for $350,000 to $500,000, which is very comparable to a residential apartment. So it doesn't price you out of the market because you suddenly decide you want to have an investment in commercial property. But the real secret is, as we discussed a moment ago, that on a strata office, your return, your net return is about 7% per annum as opposed to 3.5% for apartments. So it's not a hard calculation to make or a decision to think through when you can see that your returns, your net returns, are about double that for commercial property as it is for residential. Perhaps another myth is that commercial tenants are difficult to deal with. Well, because the commercial tenants, as we discussed, are running a business, they have a vested interest in keeping their property in good condition. And also they're more commercially minded. Their decisions are not based on emotion. They're based on facts and figures and what makes sense. And also, one of the things that you have in a commercial lease that you don't have in a residential one is a make good clause at the end of the lease. Now, with a residential property, you have a bond or a security deposit, and that's the extent of your claim against the tenant. Whereas with a commercial property, yes, you have a bond or security deposit, quite often bank guarantee. But in addition to that, there is a make good clause at the end of the lease which requires the tenant to reinstate the premises to what the condition it was when they went in. So again, it's very much a business transaction that tends to make the commercial property a far cleaner deal and provide a much more secure relationship going forward. Probably another myth is that it costs a lot more to manage commercial property. The reality is it needn't. I mean, you may choose to manage the property yourself. Sometimes that can get out of hand, particularly with some of the legislative requirements now. To have a competent managing agent acting for you is your safeguard to not only having the tenant pay on time, but also to have the property fully maintained. And even though the tenant, a commercial tenant, may be required to pay the outgoings and maintain the property, it is the managing agent who ensures that that takes place. Now, unlike residential property management, where the fees are 7% of your rental, with commercial property, it's generally 3%, maybe 4 or 5, depending on its size. A little smaller, it'll be close to 5. But what is probably most important is that a lot of commercial leases are structured such that the tenant is required to pay for the administration and management of the property. So that even though there is a fee paid to a managing agent, if the lease is properly structured, and this comes down to your initial negotiations and review of the lease documentation, that means that the cost of maintaining and managing the property professionally is actually picked up by the tenant. So I think, Ken, that covers the things. Is that the explanation you're looking for?
It does, yes. So thank you for that. Look, next week we'll definitely make a start on some of the components within the 9-step formula. And look, in particular, I'd like you to start with the importance of establishing your investment objectives and buying criteria. Anyway, until then, I wish everyone a great week.
And you too, Ken.
Thanks.